This year is dedicated to a tefillah of refuah shleima for a gentleman, Chaim Tzvi ben Yenta Bluma. I'm not familiar with the details here, but I was asked to make that announcement that the learning should be for a schut for his refuah shleima. Last week, we dealt with the page on hashtalat evarim, which is organ transplants, and the reason that I arrived at that title or at that subject had to do with the fact that the HOD, which is the organization in the United States that promotes organ donations, cards that are given out to members, asked Rabbanim should deal with the subject on Parshat Truma. And it's like a takeoff on the word Truma. Of course, the word Truma, as I mentioned last week in the Chumash, doesn't mean donation. Zotah Truma doesn't mean donation in the modern sense of the word Truma, but it means an uplifting experience. We know that the root, I know a lot of people don't like grammar, but once in a while a grammatical comment is in order. If you have any experience with Rav Shamshon Nefoil Hirsch and his commentary on the Chumash, grammar plays a major role in understanding the meaning of a word, and the word makes a sentence, and the idea is then conveyed. The Hebrew Resh Vav Mem, and it appears as a word in Parshat Shoftim, where the Torah warns the king not to excessively levilti rum levavo. Resh Vav Mem. Shouldn't be haughty. It shouldn't be too high. So Resh Vav Mem means uplifting, and Truma means an uplifting experience. And basically what the Torah was saying is that the contributions made to the Mishkan, whether it was the material of the Mishkan, or as Chazal also see the half shekel, the machzit shekel donation, these are to be uplifting experiences to you, and not cutting your losses. Some people, they think, okay, they made a donation, except their bank account now is a little bit trimmer because of the donation. And you may count it as somewhat of a loss. And the Torah is teaching us that when one donates for the purpose of Mishkan or Mikdash construction or any other house of Kedusha, and for that matter, any other category that would so be defined as tzedakah, it should not be written off as a loss, but it's actually a gain. So much so that the Chazal teach us on the Pasuk in Parshat Re'eh, Aser ta Aser, you shall give a tenth, ma'aser. There's a play on the double phrase, aser ta'aser, as if it would read osher. Osher means wealth. Aser bishvil shetit asher. You should give the tenth so that you shall become wealthy. And the Gemara teaches us that normally you cannot challenge HaKadosh Baruch Hu with regard to the performance of a mitzvah. All right, I'll be super duper careful about this mitzvah, and therefore I would like such and such in return. That is called shohad, bribing a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So you might be able to bribe a prime minister, but you can't bribe God. And the Torah says, Asher lo yikach shohad. In Sefer Tvarim, in Parshat Ekev, it says, Asher lo yikach shohad. You cannot bribe God. So Ramban there explains, Zu shohad shel mitzvah. It's a bribery by using a mitzvah. You need something, and you say, "All right, let's strike a deal with God, and you'll be, you know, more careful, more scrupulous in a particular mitzvah, and hope that there'll be a return, a positive return." You can't do that. The only thing is that there's one exception, and the exception happens to be tzedakah, that the halakha allows a person to challenge God by using the mitzvah of tzedakah for something in return, and that is why, in a mishaberach for a chole, we make a donation. It's part of the nusach of the mishaberach. We pledge to give some type of tzedakah. And it's based on a gemara in Masechet Pesachim Davchet. It says, Ha'omer sela zu l'tzedakah al menat sheyichye b'ni. If a person has a son who's very, very sick, doesn't mean he has a cold. A cold, you just give him some chicken soup and it'll be okay. But a son is critically ill, and you're davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you say you will donate sela, means a coin. It's a coin of the days of Chazal. You donate a coin of tzedakah on condition that my son shall live. The Gemara says, "Harei zu tzadik gamur." This is a righteous person. It's okay. it's okay to make such a condition. The only thing that the commentators then kick around is what happens if the son does not survive. Are you obligated to pay up because you made that kind of a promise? And some say categorically, no, you're not obligated because it was on condition. Al menat sheyichye bini, on condition that the son will survive, will live. And therefore, if he doesn't, your promise is null and void. Whereas some poskim say, no. The donation to tzedakah is totally independent of how a Kadosh Baruch Hu reacts to the story. But you're allowed to make such a pledge. Ha'omer sel azil zul tzedakah, al menat sheyichye bini, harezu tzadik gamur. And this you see with regard to the way Chazal said, aser b'shvil shetit asher. This all has to do with donating to Beit HaMikdash or donating to any type of cause that would be regarded as tzedakah. It's not supposed to be taken as a loss, but it's supposed to be taken as a gain. Now, you may say, where's the gain? You know, the accountant is going to write it off as a loss. Yeah, their accountant might today write it off as a loss, but a Kadosh Baruch Hu will see to it that ultimately it's going to be a gain. So, you know, you might think that this requires, you know, great emunah, great faith, and so on, but it's not the day-to-day Judaic practice, but it's not true. There are plenty of Jews out there who live by this, and I will mention just two interesting anecdotes. One is my father, Olav Shalom, who later in life was able to get involved in a private business where beforehand he was an employee for someone else. And then we became in private business with a partner. So there was a deal that was made that between the two of them, the other fellow was a Hasidish guy, that they would sit down at the end of each month, 10% went off at Stoka, no matter what was going on in the business, you know, even if they weren't making too much money, 10% was going off at Stoka. And the two of them would allocate, you know, where it would be going, and each one would respect the institutions of the others. Of course, my father right away said, the Amuna women, they're going to get the first ones because my mother told them to say that. And but that other fellow had no problems with it because, you know, he had his, you know, Hasidische Moizdus institutions, and my father had no problems with it. And that's how it worked. But my father told me once, it was a very rare comment, a very, very rare comment, that there was a time that the United States was in an economic slump. And industry was not doing well at all. And my father's business had to do with manufacturing tools that had a diamond tip to it, because diamond is very, very strong. These are not gems, these are industrial diamonds. And obviously, this kind of a business is directly linked to industry. When industry is up, you can expect more and more orders. When industry is down, low. And industry indeed was down, and many, many people in the field were really struggling to keep their heads above water. And my father said his business was thriving. He didn't understand why. He did not understand why he was getting orders and so on, but he attributed it to the fact that they were very careful about Ma'asar Ksafim at the end of each month. And that, you know, I took that little piece of story from my father very, very seriously. But also we had an incident when I started in the rabbinate in 1977. And as we were approaching the beginning of the calendar month March, but it was also Purim at the time, I became a rav for the first time. I was 24 years old, and in a small shul in Queens. And unlike my other chaverim, who had to go to Oshkosh somewhere to get their first positions, I was in Queens, in New York City, in Astoria, where my wife actually grew up in that neighborhood, and for a time actually davened in that shul when she. So we were familiar with the setting. This shul had a very interesting project, which I liked, which I inherited from the previous rabbi, and that was that every month there was a fundraising breakfast on a Sunday morning. Every Sunday morning, once a month, there was a breakfast, you know, bagels and lox, whatever, and some cause was there for people to bring their checkbooks. And it just switched. It was a rotation thing. One month it was the local yeshiva in West Queens, and once it was YU, and once it was Israel Bonds, and once it was this, and Yens, and etc. And I was able to bring in Yeshivat Har Etzion, my great yeshiva from Eretz Yisrael. And I even got our Rebbe Rav Lichtenstein to come and speak at one of these breakfasts, where I told him, Rebbe, do me a favor, not more than 20 minutes. These people can't handle. Because, you know, Rav Aaron needed a half hour to warm up the engine, you know. And I said, that's all they can handle, 20 minutes. And he was really good. He was really, really good. But the Rav told me when I started that position, I told him about this. He says, what you should be doing in order to show that you really mean it with regard to the mitzvah tzedakah is not just make drushes. He said, drushes, I know you know how to make drushes. But he said, you should match the highest donor in every appeal. Now, thank God we didn't have multimillionaires there. Thank God for that. But the Rav knew the economic strata of what Astoria was, and he had an idea what it was, where in those days, if people were giving $18 or $25 at such a monthly appeal, that was considered okay. And if you gave $50, you know, that was really, you know, wonderful. If you give $100, you know, you were really a tzaddik. So there was always one or two people who gave $250. That was like top dollar for a monthly appeal. And then I remember the Rav said, you match that, and you're not going to have to make one speech about tzedakah, and people are going to understand that because unfortunately, there are many, many Rabbanim who give wonderful drushes about tzedakah. When it comes to giving, they're usually, they sometimes are at the lower end of the spectrum in terms of how much they themselves are contributing after they make this, you know, fire and brimstone drusha that everybody else should be giving. And the Rav told me, talk it over with your wife, and, you know, he was a smart man, and I did. And we decided we're going to give it a try, because at that time, that was a lot of money. It was a lot of money. Every month, $250 for tzedakah. Because I knew this guy was going to give $250 for tzedakah, for every appeal. Fine. And it turned out that the promise of Aser Beshvil Shetit Asher, I never became a Rothschild, but it never was a loss. It never was felt as a loss. And there were always things that just min hashamayim came by my way, which gave me opportunity to earn money that I would not have had otherwise. And it was true. It actually was true. It worked. It was a policy that actually worked. And it also worked exactly what the Rav said. People were saying, one second, if the rabbi's giving $250, I'm going to give $18. So the $18 donations became 25, and the 25 donations became 36, and the 36 donations became 50. And there was an upgrade, and all of a sudden, the sum total at the monthly appeals grew, sometimes even substantially, because it was what's called dugma ishit. This is a personal example, and you don't have to say anything. The Rav was a smart man, because he told me at the time when I started in the Rabbanus, and this is now 41 years ago, 1977, the Rav said that when his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, became the Rav of Chasalovich, you may have heard from me, you know, more detail how that happened. I'll just say in a word, the town Chasalovich was a Lubavitch town. So what in the world is a Lubavitch town taking a thoroughbred Litvak, you know, son of Rav Chaim from Brisk, as their Rav? They had a skirmish with the previous Rav, and it came to a dentira, and the Dayanim ruled in favor of the Rav against the people, so they had to penalize the people, and the punishment was that their next Rav has to be a misnagid, has to be a Litvisher misnagid. That is some punishment for Chasidei Chabad. And they were Yerei Shamayim, and they accepted the din, they accepted it. So they sent a delegation to Brisk, to Rav Chaim, and ask Eitzah, maybe if he can recommend. And he said, go to Pruzhan and invite my son, Rav Moshe. He's a tolerant person. He will be a good Rav. And truth is, he was a very good Rav for these people. And so the Rav told me that when Rav Moshe Soloveitchik took on the position, so his father, Rav Chaim, the Rav from Brisk, gave him a bracha. And the bracha was, don't, among other things, forget that a Rav is not exempt in two mitzvot. One is Talmud Torah. People think sometimes a Rav is so busy teaching and doing community work, he doesn't have time to crack a sefer and read and learn on his own. So don't forget, a Rav is not exempt from the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And the second, he said, tzedakah. Because you sometimes get caught up with all your rhetoric and everything, you forget that you're also supposed to be an active participant. And the truth of the matter is, the Rav said once that he asked two people about what the position, he quoted an uncle, and the uncle happened to have been Meir Bar Ilan. The reason how that happened, that they were uncles, because Meir Bar Ilan is the Netziv of Volozhin, the Netziva Volozhin, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was Rosh Shiva in Volozhin, had a co-Rosh Shiva who was the Rav's great-grandfather, his namesake, Rav Yosef Dov Ber Soloveitchik, the Beis Halevi, and his son, Rav Chaim, the famous Rav Chaim from Brisk, before he became Rav from Brisk, he was a Ram, he taught the yeshiva in Volozhin. And this Rav Chaim marries the granddaughter of the Netziv. So they were really mishpacha. So the Rav had opportunity of talking to his uncle, Rav Meir Berlin, who has changed his name here in Israel to Bar Ilan, in conformity with all the great Zionist leaders, Hebraicized the name. And Rav Meir Bar Ilan told him that he asked two Rabbanim, what is the most important feature of being a Rav? He asked the Rabbi Chil Mechel Alevi Epstein, the author of the Orach HaShulchan, and he asked Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav of Brisk. He said, the Orach HaShulchan said, Sapaskin and Shilas, to respond to halachic inquiries. That's his job. That's his main job. Everything else dances around that. And Rav Chaim said, to involve yourself in chesed activities with the tzibur. And everything else dances around that. And the Rav said that on Rav Chaim's matzeva, it reads Rav Chesed. And the truth is, I was there often enough, and it does. It says a lot more, but it says that one of the first words on the matzeva is Rav Chesed, that he was involved in great acts of Chesed. The Rav used to speak of the time that the town of Brisk, there was a fire, and in those days, if there was a fire, you know, so they didn't have fire engines, everybody stopped what they were doing and brought pails of water. And half of Brisk burned down. Dafka, the house of Rav Chaim and the shul, didn't burn down. It was a different side of the town. But the people who were homeless moved into the shul and slept on the floor for a while until their homes would be rebuilt. So Rav Chaim decided to leave his own home and sleep in the shul on the floor with the people who were there, to give them chizuk, to give them strength and so on. And they said that he would get down on all fours and give piggyback rides to the little children there just to make them feel, get a smile out of them. This is the famous Rav Chaim that people study his Torah in the yeshivas with all the great splitting hairs in halachic logic. Nobody would think that this was the Rav Chaim who was just involved in chesed day in and day out. And that obviously the Rav actually felt that it was, that the bottom line is it's a combination of the two. You know, you cannot excuse yourself from halachic inquiries, but also from chesed work. And this has a lot to do with now what we talked about with Hashlalat Evarim. Last week, we dealt with the core issue that I wanted to bring out. And that is that there is still room after the demise of a human being for Kadosh Baruch Hu to enter into the record merits and demerits. This is a great idea that the Rav said. Understanding in source number 5, Sifrei Chayim, Sifrei Meitim, Petuchim Lefanav, that on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the books are open, normally interpreted that this has to do with the question of mi yichyeh, mi yamut, who's going into this book, who's going into that book, and that's how we offer our tefillot of Zechreinu l'chayim, melech hafetz b'chayim, v'chotveinu b'sefer chayim, and b'ne'ila, v'chotmeinu b'sefer chayim. That's the way we were brought up. And the Rav comes along and he says, no. It means that on Yom Kippur, Kadosh Baruch Hu has the books open for those who are alive, and he has the books open for all those who departed a long time ago, or even yesterday for that matter, because there's unfinished business. And one of the unfinished business, the Rav felt, is that sometimes a person can pledge tzedakah and it doesn't pay itself out while the person's still alive. And the Yorshim, you know, pick up on the pledge and they do fulfill what the deceased parent wanted to have donated. That person's going to receive the credit for the donation posthumously, among other things. Even Kaddish, we said, when a person says Kaddish, so it gives a schut for the niftar. And that's why Kaddish has become so popular. But here too, with regard to Hashtalat Evarim, a person is halachically dead. And if he's not halachically dead, you can't take out the heart or the lung or whatever. But that's really a core issue that we'll talk about today. But a person is dead, so lo hametim yahalluya velo kol yordei duma, what I wrote in source number 4. That's it. Person dies. Ability to bring Kvod Shemayim into this world has come to a dead end. So it's true 99.9%. But there is this factor of unfinished business. And if a person ends up saving another human life after he himself has died, that's going to be regarded as a merit in his credit, even posthumously. And that's an important factor. So
in the HOD card from the United States, they give you this option of checking off whether they don't tell you the names, but you see, if you know the views, you know who we're talking about, whether you're adopting Rav Moshe Feinstein's view or adopting Rav Yoshev's view. And the basic machloket had to do with what constitutes the moment of death. According to Rav Yoshev, Zichron LeBracha, you have to, if there's heart beating, even though respiration has stopped, and that can happen, the person is still halachically alive, and you have to wait till the heart stops beating. Now that can happen if a person is hooked up to a heart-lung machine and so on. It can happen. But the other problem is that if you're waiting that long, then most of the organs are then going to be useless. You're not going to be able to use them for transplant. And it so says on the card of HOD that if you check that option, if that's your halachic view of death, you should be aware of the fact that the possibilities of using an internal organ for a transplant has been seriously curtailed and reduced. Whereas Rav Moshe Feinstein took a different stand, and he believed that it has to do with respiration. But what was his big chiddush? In his understanding of how respiration functions, and here his son-in-law, Rav Tendler, was a key player in giving Rav Moshe Feinstein to understand this whole process, it has to do with the function of the brain stem. And if the brain stem is dead, then the person is actually dead, and it's irrevocable. It's irrevocable. Now, it's possible that there still might be some movement in the heart. It might still be. I don't know if you know or no, but if the person dies, it's possible that the nails are still growing. There's still some molecular activity going on. So the question is, when exactly is a person called dead from a halakhic point of view? And that is an important question, because there is a mitzvah in the Torah of kvurat hamet, of burial, and if there are no reasons for delay, then the mitzvah is that person should be buried that day. Ki kavor tikbarenu bayomahu, on that very, very day. Now we know that many times that halakha is somehow pushed aside because of, I don't want to use the word convenience. Convenience is not a nice thing to say, to push aside a mitzvah, but because of realities of kvor hamet. And that is, a member of the family, like a son or daughter or spouse, or brother or sister, who are going to sit shiva. They're not here. They might be abroad, the chutz laretz. And it's going to be impossible to bring them, you know, today. It's going to take time. We'll have to have the levaya tomorrow. So that's something that's acceptable from a halakhic point of view. And furthermore, there could be a scenario where if you do the levaya that day, bo bayom, there will be limited attendance. And perhaps the family feels that for the kavod of that person, the person deserves a little bit better attendance at the levaya. There is a concept of that. More and more people come to the levaya, it's more kvod hamet. That if it'll be done tomorrow and more people will know about it, you know, you get an ad in the Jerusalem Post already in the morning and people will see about it. So that will generate a more respectable audience. So that's also acceptable. And then there's a whole question about here in Yerushalayim with the Chevra Kadisha, they don't want to have halanat hamet, which means the body should not stay overnight without being buried. And here there's negotiations with the various Chevra Kadishas, how to work this out if there is a delay. But the fact is, it's an issue. It's an issue. It's not an insurmountable issue, but it's an issue. So some have said that in a case of organ donation, so it takes time till they operate on the cadaver and take out and remove and so on. So it may delay the levaya. Okay, so it may delay the levaya, but that's permissible because we're here to save another person's life. So we're allowed to do that. That's really a very, very small issue here of delaying. But the problem of accepting Rav Yoshev Pesak, which may have the person rendered halachically alive for a few more days, maybe even a week or two, whatever it is, when viewed against the position of Rav Moshe Feinstein, then you've been delaying kvura for a day, for 2 days, for 3 days, for a week. You're delaying shiva, the mourning process, for a day or two or three or a week, which, who said you're allowed to do that? So, okay, so we have a machloket. So you may argue and say that when you have a dispute of this nature, and this is a life and death question with regard to the donor, It's a life and death question, because going to Rav Yashiv, if you start removing these vital organs, according to the opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein, you're a murderer. You're a murderer, because you're going to guarantee the earlier death of the donor. So that's something that a lot of people have taken, you know, seriously. I mean, seriously enough to say that you cannot be an organ donor in accordance with the view of Rav Moshe Feinstein. But the chief rabbinate here in Eretz Yisrael, from the days of Rav Goren Zatzal, and you have to realize Rav Goren became chief rabbi in 1972, just about the time that organ transplants started becoming known and popular. I mean, the first one was Christian Barnard in 68 in South Africa, in Cape Town, but then it spread to the United States and so on. But by 1972, 73, it was already becoming more and more known and fashionable. When I was in Rabbi Tendler's class in biology, I heard him in Shiurim and Halacha, but he wasn't my Rebbe in the sense of a Gemara Shir, but he also was my biology teacher. We had a section for biology for non-science majors, or as some called it, biology for poets or biology for idiots. Whatever it was, that's where I was with a lot of guys from YU. And Rav Tendler, She'arich Yamav, felt that even though this was supposed to be, you know, an easy rider type of course, it wasn't the guys who were doing pre-med. But nevertheless, he was the head of the department. He wanted to take one of the sections of this science for bio for non-science majors, and it was extremely popular. We had tons of students in this class because we knew the syllabus was not a syllabus. What he was going to be discussing, what was on Rav Moshe Feinstein's table the day before. That's what he would do. Rav Tendler taught us what he called the art of constructive batola. It was a great idea, great line. Batola, which means you have a syllabus, you have a text, but that's not what you're going to be teaching. You know? He's going to be doing whatever he wants to do. And he knew that it didn't make a bit of a difference if we completed the syllabus, didn't complete the syllabus. So we learned a little science on, you know, on the side. But the issues that he brought out were scientific subjects that his father-in-law, Rav Moshe Feinstein, was dealing with. And I was there in 71, 72, when Rav Moshe was dealing with the transplant and the heart transplant. So in source number, take a look at the second page, source number 7. We'll get back to 6 in a moment. In the middle of the second page, Be'inyan hashtalat halev l'chole. Here, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva that was written in Adar Sheni Tavshin Lamed Chet. That's 1978. That's 1978. And he writes to, if you read the who is he's addressing, Mem Ayin Kaf means Ma'alat Kvodo, Yedidi Anichbad Vechashuv Ma'od, and he calls him Harav Gaon, Morena Rav Kalman Kahana Shlita. Anybody knows who Kalman Kahana was? He was a member of the Knesset. He was the Rav of Kibbutz Chofetz Chaim, from the Poalei. He was the leader, one of the leaders of Poalei Agudat Yisrael, which was known as PAI in abbreviation. It hardly exists today as an organization, but that's the organization that sponsored the Ezra Youth Group, and they have kibbutzim like Shalabim is PAI, and Chofetz Chaim is PAI, and things of this. So Rav Kalman Kahana asked Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Moshe Feinstein already established early in the game, in the days that I heard Rabbi Tendler in class speak of this, that one of the issues that has to be determined is not only the moment of death of the donor, but what are the chances that the recipient is going to survive? Because you have a person who's sick, right? They don't do heart transplants on every Tom, Dick, and Harry. They obviously have many, many different treatments for people with cardiac disease. But if there's nothing else is working, the person is suffering, and this just is a last resort. So you have to realize the people who are the recipients, the early recipients, were very, very sick people to start with before they went into the OR room. They were very, very sick people. And the statistical probability they're going to survive this kind of a massive open heart surgery was also not so great. So here you're dealing with a scenario where if you did not operate, look, the man's not going to live long, or the woman's not going to live long, but they're not going to die tomorrow. It doesn't look like they're, you know, looking at the Malach HaMavet tomorrow. It may take a half a year, may take a year, and it's a rough going during that half a year or year. But if you operate and the operation is not successful, and a person dies within a week, what you've basically done is you've moved up his day of death. And you're not allowed to do that. So what type of medical procedure would then be halachically permissible? So Rav Moshe Feinstein makes a decision. I don't remember all his proofs, but he says that we have to have at least a better than 50% success record. It's got to be a scenario where more than 50% of the people who go through a particular treatment will survive. And now the question is, survive until when? Survive until Yemot HaMashiach? I mean, everybody's going to die anyway. So what's the question? So Rav Moshe was willing to buy into the doctor's definition of what they think is called good survival rate, 5 years. That's what they said. If a person survives a procedure for 5 years, that means the procedure was successful. Now we know very well that there are people who have all kinds of transplants and other things, Lo aleinu, cancer patients, that you know things are in remission, but at the end of the day, things crop up again. So that doesn't mean that the treatment failed. Quite the contrary. The person would have died within a year, but now he lived 7 years. You know, so Baruch Hashem, you know, it gave him a new lease on life, and he had a feel of quality, good quality life. So Rav Moshe was willing to buy into this, that there had to be at least 5 years of survival rate in order to give a hechsher to a heart transplant. He was speaking specifically about heart transplant in this tshuva. And in 1978, he was not yet convinced that we've achieved 50% of success rate in heart transplant. They were already doing heart transplants in, you know, at 75, 76, 77, 78, but the patients, most of them, more than 50%, were dying within the five-year span. If that's the case, Rav Moshe still felt that he cannot authorize it. The problem is there's a catch-22. How do you get to the 50% survival rate? You have to, pardon the expression, fill up a cemetery. You have to keep on doing this until you get it right. Each time there's an operation, they learn. They learn from the mistakes. They learn from what we might be able to do to improve the procedure next time around so that the next patient has a better shot of survival. And you could not have expected the South African surgeon, Christian Barnard, to have a success rate. It was an unbelievable pioneering experience. And if you wouldn't have had the pioneer, you know, you'd never get to where we are today. We're clearly, today, we are over the 50% mark of a heart transplant survival rate of 5 years. And that's why most of the Rabbanim would authorize and say, yeah, you can do it. I mean, it's chancy. It's still chancy. There's no doubt. You know, if somebody tells me you have 55% chance of surviving, you know, you're looking at 45% there also. It's nothing to sneeze at. But nevertheless, if you're giving a halachic decision that it's okay, so Rav Moshe Feinstein in 1978 was still hyper cautious about giving a green light, giving a heter for cardiac transplants at the time. But with regard to the core issue of the definition of death, Rav Tendler himself wrote an article in a YU journal back in 1971, which I have home, but Rav Moshe Feinstein speaks about it, if you turn back to the first page, in source number 6. And the tshuva is addressed to none other than his son-in-law, Rav Tendler. We're in 1976, Iyar, you know when he writes it? He writes it on Yom HaTzmaut. I couldn't believe it. And I looked at the date. Hey Iyar, the 5th of Iyar, Tavshin Lamed Vav. Rav Moshe, you know, wasn't bothered by the question of saying Halil on Yom HaTzmaut. He didn't. But that's a different parsha. Kviat Eit HaMavet, the definition of the time of death. In source number 6, in the bottom, Bezrat Hashem, Hey Iyar Tavshin Lamed Vav, Malat Kvodo, Chatani, my son-in-law, Hanichbad Ve'ahuv Lanu, and okay, Arav Agon, Moreno, Rav Moshe Dovid Tendler, Shlita. Fine. Now we're on the second side on top. So we know who the address was. Hinei Bidvar Yidiat Mitata Adam, regarding the question of
the definition of death. It's in the Gemara. What's in the Gemara? If it's in the Gemara, so why is there a dispute? Because the Gemara is subject to interpretation. That's why it's a dispute. Like everything else, there's a dispute. The Gemara says this, but what does the Gemara mean? So the Gemara is talking about a collapsed house. Like we had yesterday in Baca, in Rehov Dan, a balloon gas explodes. It causes a collapse, partial collapse of a building. And it falls on the parking lot under the roof. Somebody's trapped under there. Ultimately, the person actually was killed. Yeah, the person was killed. Yeah, unfortunately. Right? Now, let's assume this happened on Shabbat. Let's assume that accident happened on Shabbat. And you know that there was somebody, obviously he's not a Shomer Shabbos, but he was sitting in the car. And you can see that somebody there is unconscious. He's not. You're calling out, he's not responding. You don't know if he's dead or not, obviously. So, safek, pikuach nefesh, you're allowed to bring cranes and start moving, you know, the collapsed material, everything. Oh, sure, it could be Machal Shabbos, just because of a maybe. But as you get closer and closer to the body, the question is, do they have to stop doing that work on Shabbat if they know unequivocally that the person is dead? So the halacha is, once they know, they've determined that the person would be dead, then there's no longer a green light for them to continue the work of moving the collapsed material. They're just going to have to wait till after Shabbat. There's no heter, there's no permissibility. So if that's the case, how do you know when the person's dead? So there, the Gemara says, Be nafal mapolet al ha'adam, a collapsed wall on a person, shemifakrim etagal, you remove the boulders one after one, afilu b'shabbat, ubotkim ad chotamo, and you check until his nose. What are you going to check by the nose? By putting a feather by the nose and see if the feather is moving, if the man's breathing. Basically what the Gemara is saying, you check if the person is breathing. And furthermore, ifse kein berambam perik bet mishabbat alachayutet, this is how the Rambam decides, ubishulchan aruch aruch hayim siman shin kaftet, sif dalet, she'im lo hirgishu shum chiyut, you stick pins in the person and you see no reaction whatsoever, which means there's not just an unconscious person may flinch because of pain. It means the nervous system is not functioning. Bedin metu shehu bebdikat haneshima. You know for sure the man is no longer with us, and so on. Now, one thing has to be clear. In the days of the Gemara and in the days of the Rambam, they really did not have a clue how the brain functions. And if you think that today we know how the brain functions, we know about 10% about how the brain functions, which is a lot. Which is a lot. We know quite a lot about the brain. And we know that the brain is divided into different sections. And we know which section is responsible for different activities. That's why if a person has a partial stroke on the right side of the brain, he's going to be paralyzed in the left side of his body. We know all that today. And we know how it affects vision. We know how it affects hearing. We know how it affects speech. There are certain areas in the brain that if not affected, the person will still be able to speak after a stroke. If they are affected, perhaps he can still walk around, but he can't speak. Those areas were affected. But those are the cerebral parts of the brain. But the brain stem is really that the control box that really takes care of the bodily functions, like respiration.
Involuntary.
And if that is completely dead, then it's irrevocable. There's never been a situation in medical history where a brain stem was ruled medically dead that the person came back. We know stories of people who were considered dead and came back. But the question is, how dead were they?
and so on. But we know that if tests were done. Okay, I missed that. Not dead enough. Okay. The issue that came out with Rav Moshe Feinstein is that there was an insistence of how to be unequivocal about the testing in the hospital that the brainstem is actually dead. And that went through different stages of committees of doctors and ethicists and rabbis and jurists. And ultimately, by the year 2009, it became pretty standardized and accepted in all hospitals in Israel what the test would be. It's elaborate, by the way. But what they're measuring for, what they're looking for, how they do it, who does it, who's trained to do it, and so on. But if the person passes all these tests and is now, you know, ruled as dead, unequivocally, then the...
What? He fails all tests.
Well, he fails all tests. That's how you look at it, from which point of view. Then the Rabbanut Rashid falls back to a position it took in 1986, based on Rav Moshe Feinstein, that you can honor the person's request and use an organ for transplant, and it's going to work. It's going to work. I'll just digress for a second, that Rav Tendler, in private discussion with him several years ago, in dealing with the activity, the work that my wife and now my daughter is in the field as well, of cochlear implants, here we've got a person who was born deaf. Or perhaps a person who was born with hearing, but totally lost the hearing because of meningitis, because of some trauma, whatever it is, person went deaf. It can happen. And a hearing aid does nothing, because a hearing aid will help if there's still some residual hearing. Because a hearing aid is nothing but an amplifier. And if you have no hearing, so you can have the best hearing aid in the world, it will do nothing for you. But what does the cochlear implant do? It's actually a bypass road. It bypasses... The hears in the middle ear are no longer vibrating, or the auditory neural pathway is dead. There's a nerve that just doesn't function any longer, which would bring the impulses of the hearing that are translated. When you hear, the sound goes into the ear, goes into the middle ear, it's translated into pulses. It's then projected along a neural pathway to the brain for interpretation of sound. What does a cochlear implant do? It installs in the head a processor and has an outer part that's connected with a magnet. Pashut with a magnet. You can take it off and now you're deaf. Put it back on, now you hear. And what it does is it takes the hearing, instead of through the ear, but it goes through here, this room, and it translates it electronically and sends the impulse directly to the brain for interpretation. So what does a person hear? Sound. And now the question is it the same sound that a normal, healthy person hears, yes or no? That's a discussion in itself. But many years ago, Rav Tendler gave me personally a psak halacha that we printed here in the Torah Tidbit several times over before Rosh Hashanah. The Rav Tendler says that unlike a hearing aid where the person is hearing through a microphone, basically, and that becomes a shaila, whether hearing shofar through amplification is considered hearing the shofar sound. So of course, on Yom Tov, you have no other choice. So you tell a person, listen what you can listen, and that's it. You know, then God will give you credit, whatever he gives you credit. But do you want that individual to be the Baal Tokeah? To blow shofar and shul for others? If there's a question mark whether he himself is fulfilling the mitzvah, you may not do that. But Rav Tendler said, a person with a cochlear implant, he said, can blow shofar in my Munsi shul, he said. He's so convinced that what you're hearing is authentic sound. Why? Because he said hearing is a function of brain interpretation. And what the and this is not amplification. What's happening here is the brain is interpreting what is receiving these electronic impulses through the processor. It's doing what God did on a different road. That's all. But what's ultimately happening to the person is the same experience as a person who hears sound. And it's just a different way of interpreting the impulse to become the sound that you appreciate and so on. And therefore, such a person could be the Bakaira for Megillah, and he can be the Baal Tukeyan, Rosh Hashanah, and so on. It's a big landmark psak. In Tchumin, that the annual that comes out from Alon Shvut, Machon Somet, every year, already back in the volume 25, there was an ENT specialist, Dr. Brahma, who wrote such an halachic article in the same direction. And then 4 years later, in Chavtet, Rav Nachum Rabinowitz from Yeshiva Ma'al Adumim, a very noted Pesach, also took the identical stand that with a cochlear implant, you have a din of a shomea, someone who hears. And just to be honest, there are some in the Haredi world who've, you know, do not want to accept it, but I think that has a lot to do with, you know, the very conservative stance on halakha, and some people are just not willing to be bold enough to go along with the novelty of modernity, and they just can't bring themselves to say yes. You know, so they'll say suffix, you know, to doubt or whatever. You know, once they say suffix, then you know the guy's boxed out. But Rav Tendler was very, very, very clear about this. And this has to do also with the way Rav Moshe Feinstein understood respiration. It's a function of the brain. A function of the brain. So here you have this definition. And if you sign on the HOD card in favor of Rav Moshe Feinstein's definition, so then you do allow for a wider use of organ transplants. Let me just mention, 2 days ago, last week rather, there was a chayal who was unfortunately killed on Kfish Shesh. Some wild, drunken driver from Mizrach Yerushalayim. It was not a terrorist act. The guy accrued 177 tickets from the police in his career already, and he was still on the road. And he unfortunately, two chayalim were killed. He hit a convoy of jeeps that were resting on the side of the road. And the family donated all the vital organs that could be donated from this chayal. It was just in the paper the other day, and I thought it was a very, very big mitzvah. And the family had some comfort, there was some nechama, knowing that, you know, la'achar mavet, something still was able to be done in a positive way. So comes Rav Gorin in 1979, when he was chief rabbi in Israel, 79-80, and he prints an article. He says, look, there are two opinions out there about the definition of death. We understand that. And if all what we're talking about is the particular individual, his dying with no consequence of a transplant, so what's really up for grabs? The delay of the levaya, the delay of sitting shiva, that's all that's up for grabs. If you're pasuking, if you hold like Rav Yosher, if the person's going to live, halakhically live another few days. So that's really what's governing this whole thing. But now that we have a scenario that somebody else can be saved. So now it's a new issue. It's a pikuach nefesh now. What right do you have to adopt the chumrah stance of Rav Yoshev and let that other person perish as well? Do you not have an obligation to accept the more lenient opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein and allow for the possibility of the transplant? And that's very, very important. In other words, what Rav Gorin does here, he introduces now an ability to be decisive because what's happening is pikuach nefesh. Now, if we go back 250 years to the days of Prague, where the Noidim Yehuda, Rabbi Cheskel Alevi Landau, was the Rav, so there was the scenario of, famous scenario, of two sick people in the same hospital, and one was for sure on his way out dying, who's a goses. And the doctors felt that they can use something from his body to help the other one, who was also in a serious illness, but not dying today or tomorrow, but if he doesn't have that treatment, he's going to die. And the Noid Behuda allowed the autopsy. There the question was the autopsy. Because the autopsy is nivul hamet. The body doesn't belong to the person, it belongs to God. We are just the trustees for God to make sure that we take care of the body and bring it to kfura. That's all. So you're not allowed to have any benefit from the body. It's asur ba'ana'ah. But if you're going to save somebody else, says the Noid of Yehuda, so it's a mitzvah. Of course we should do it. And so too with defiling a corpse. You're not allowed to defile a corpse. It's a nivul hamet. But here it's not defiling. Here you're doing something to save. So it's okay. Rav Tendler, commenting on this Noid of Yehuda, said that what was the next door in the same hospital 250 years ago in Prague is now halfway around the globe, because we can take out an internal organ and have it in a compartment that's going to be preserved, and fly it over to Tokyo and use it in an operating theater in Japan. It's not the problem. It's the problem that the only reason that the Night Buddha said next door, because if it'd be anything else, the question wouldn't even happen 250 years ago. They didn't know about refrigeration and how to store organs and so on. So if anybody today says, oh, but Night Buddha said just the same hospital, you know, that's wrong. That's wrong. I don't know if I told you last week the story from Ramosh Feinstein from Borough Park, from Maimonides Hospital. So I'll say it again. I'll say it for the first time. I used to daven in a shul, my uncle shul, in the Borough Park, and it was 2 blocks from Maimonides Hospital in Borough Park. And there was a situation. We had doctors, you know, some interns and residents who used to daven by us for Shabbatot. So we used to be privy of all kinds of interesting things going on at the hospital. So there was a maisa. This was the time where here in Israel, whenever they discovered bones in any construction site, I mean, Meir Sharon went crazy because there were demonstrations, autopsies. It became like the big issue. Like, we're going to save the world, you know, if we don't have autopsies here. I remember the then Director General of Shari Tzedek, Professor Meir, who by profession was a pathologist. Meir Sharon guys almost killed him physically. They almost killed him. I remember there's what was going on here in Eretz Yisrael. And it spilled over to, you know, Haredi neighborhoods in Williamsburg and Borough Park and whatever, because, you know, they're part of the action. Okay, fine. Here's this gentleman who's part of that Haredi community, was dying. And in the hospital itself, there was a choyle, there was another person who could use something from that person who was dying. After the person's death, they would be able to open him up and whatever it was, I don't know the details. But the person said, no. You know, you can't do an autopsy. It's usur. I mean, here's a person who already in his head was, you know, participant in demonstrations against Israel, against the autopsies and so on. And here, of all things, he's being asked to sign to do an autopsy on his own body. So, of course, the answer is no. So they explained to him, they had, you know, Shem Shabbos doctors, the B'nai Torah, and they explained that you're going to save somebody's life. No! So they called Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Ramosha told them over the phone, says, I heard the story, I'm telling you, they can do it. So they told him in the name of Ramosha Feinstein. And the guy said, no, he didn't want to hear from it. So they called back Ramosha Feinstein. Ramosha Feinstein said, I want to talk to him. So Ramosha gets on the phone with this choyle, and he tells him, he says, look, you know, you have to do this. It's a tremendous mitzvah. It's a tremendous mitzvah. The fact that we're against autopsies, that's one thing. But this is a scenario where it's a mitzvah. So he says, no. To Rav Moshe. So Rav Moshe says, look, if you say yes, I promise you all of my Olam Haba. Now, I don't know if anybody's a balabos to make that kind of a gift or a promise, but this is what the doctors told us, Rav Moshe said on the phone. He said, I promise you all, you can have all of my Olam Haba, just say yes. And the guy said no. And he died, and the other guy died. So this story does not have a happy ending at all. And the reason why I tell it over is because sometimes there's a fine line between education and brainwashing. You get brainwashed to a certain idea and nobody can move you. That is a problem of chinuch. To think that a Godel Hador is telling you to do something and you're going to say no, there's something wrong with this picture. Something really, really wrong with this picture. And maybe, you know, he was worried that if Rabbeinu says that they can do an autopsy, well, then autopsy is not the worst thing in the world. You know, like a... He just couldn't bring himself to do that. He was so locked into, you know, that mode of thinking. And unfortunately, that's what happened. But Rav Goren felt that the scenario of a pikuach nefesh standing on the side demands that you accept the lenient opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein in the terms of determining the moment of death. Of course, Rav Tendler didn't believe it was lenient at all. He said, this is it. And this is, you know, what the brainstem does. And when the brainstem is irrevocably dead, the person is no longer here, and we can do something here and save another person. So this is where it stands today in Israel. And the option exists when you do a license renewal. The organization here is called Adi. That's in memory of somebody who died, and the family set up this organization. And you do have here, you're given a few options. And one option is you can check off a person, the doctors can use any organ, whatever they want. Or a person wants to delineate what yes, what not. And the reason why that's important, for some people, psychologically, they have hang-ups. There's even an issue about corneas, whether cornea is permissible or not, because a person who has vision problems and they want to do a cornea transplant, is that called pikuach nefesh? So there's a whole discussion in the poskim whether a blind person is considered a dead person. It's called ani chashiv kameit, iver chashiv kameit. So if a blind person is considered on a certain level like a dead person, because he's so limited and handicapped, then giving a cornea is pikuach nefesh, you know, on that level. Many poskim hold that, by the way. But some don't. And therefore,
blind
in
one eye.
What? Blind in one eye is not blind. Blind in one eye is not blind. That's not blind. But total blindness is considered the chashiv kemeit. But then the other issue that's really burning in some circles is the issue of tchiyat ha-meitim. That if they're going to remove vital organs, what about what's going to happen at the end of days? The truth is, the Rambam was accused of not really believing in tchiyat ha-meitim, that forced him to write a whole letter in 1191, Ma'amar Tchiyat HaMitim, to put down his views. And it's interesting that it seems from the Mishnah Torah that the Rambam says one thing, and in his letter called the letter on Tchiyat HaMitim, he's not saying the same thing. The classic understanding, let's just use the Ramban as the classic, is that when we talk about the end of days, Acharit HaYamim, so we're talking about a composite of Mashiach coming, everybody coming to Eretz Yisrael, perfection, spiritual perfection, and physical perfection. This is Tchiyat HaMitim time. It's all happening in the same hullabaloo. The Rambam does not accept that at all. The Rambam believes that Yamot HaMashiach is one thing, and that's going to be a political revival in Eretz Yisrael. As he says, and he quotes the Amora Shmuel, Ein bein olam hazeh l'yamot HaMashiach ela shiabud malchiyot bulvad, that we're not going to be subservient to foreign countries, which to a large degree we're achieving in our own days. The Rambam believes there will be no supernatural miracles. Things are going to happen in a normal historic progression here in Eretz Israel. But he also believes there will be restoration of prophecy. We're not there yet, but okay. But Olam Haba, the Rambam says, that's something else. That's the world of spirit, the world of neshamot. After a person dies, the body dies, the spirit, the neshama is still around, and there's a world out there called Olam Haba, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has, what we call about, talk about schar v'onish, reward and punishment, we shouldn't accept it and understand it like, you know, you can get an ice cream or you can get burnt in Gehenna. The Rambam doesn't use those at all. He believes that Olam Haba means that the neshama becomes acquainted with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the level that as a human being, he or she was never able to be acquainted with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Ki lo yir'ani ha'adam v'chai, Moshe Rabbeinu said, Hareini na kvodecha, I want to see your essence. And the answer was, as a living being, it's impossible. And this leads the Rambam to suggest that after 120 years, it is possible in that world of neshamot. One second. And Tchiyat HaMeitim according to Rambam is way beyond all of this historically, way beyond. But the Rambam believes that only those who believed in the power of Tchiyat HaMeitim will it happen, a fusion of neshama and guf. Exactly how it's going to happen, the Rambam doesn't have a clue how Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to pull this off. But furthermore, and this is shocking to many people, the Rambam believes that the person is going to die again. Because only HaKadosh Baruch Hu lives forever. There will be, Tchiyat HaMeitim does not mean that you're going to live forever. But it means that you're going to have a second, for those who believe, V'ne'eman ata l'chiyot meitim, there's going to be another opportunity of the fusion of body and neshama. But it's going to live out its time as well. Death will not be the tragic, sad event that it is today. And this is the idea that Yeshayahu speaks about of Macha Hashem Elokim Dim'a Me'al Kol Panim. There won't be tears, and it will be a completely different experience of ending one's life, but it's going to necessarily, according to Rambam, come to an end. The idea of what is left in a grave after a short amount of time, one doesn't have to worry about his lung or heart or kidney or cornea or any of that. Just as sometimes I stand under the rotunda opposite the crematorium in Majdanek, and we look at the 8 tons of human ash and bones staring us in the face, I don't have to give the Rabbanim Shalom an eitzah. How are you going to pull off Triyat HaMetim? He doesn't need my eitzahs, my advice of how to do something like that. A person who believed in Triyat HaMetim, that person will be part of that era. But that's something the Rambam says projected much later in time, and hence he felt that he would rather not talk about or elaborate about this in his various halachic books, which led some to suggest that perhaps he really was not ay-ay-ay with this whole belief, and that's what generated the letter. So at least now, you know, he's putting his position crystal clear, which to some people is far from crystal clear, even after the letter, but that's the way the Rambam was. Our job is, you know, to do what we can to bring Kavod Shamayim to this world while we're here. What the next mission is going to be, when we cross that bridge, you know, we'll get there and we'll deal with it. But in the meantime, the message of Hashtalat Evarim is that when a person can help somebody, you get that opportunity sometimes, even after a person is no longer on this world, a person can continue with the great message of V'chai Bahem, V'lo She'yamut Bahem, which is really what keeps Am Yisrael going. Okay, next Wednesday, Mirt Hashem, will be Tanit Esther, but we will have a shir. I'll just not bring a drink in. But we will have a shir. There's no reason why we shouldn't have a shir. And we'll deal with some Purim issues. All right, so don't bring Ham and Tasha in anyway, okay? Yeah, you can do something.
I think I heard, I'm quoting accurately, between two non-Haredi rabbis, and my business as usual.